entitled Joining Worlds of Knowledge, Secular and Vaishnav Academies. So for this session we have three distinguished speakers, not speakers but conversationes, some word like that in some language that expresses exactly what I'm trying to say, and I don't know what it is. But we're going to have a conversation. And I'd like to introduce the speakers. We have Matsya Avatara Prabhu, who is the director of the Centro Studio Bhaktivedanta. Say it properly.
Centro Studio Bhaktivedanta.
That's it in Italian. Okay, we have Pranava Das, who has already been introduced to us from the University of Gothenburg and Associate Research Project with Gothenburg for Hindu Studies, and Dr. Federico Scorcini Verbandas, who is in universities of Florence and Rome in the area of the history of religion and involved in some very good research projects internationally. So the format we will take, and this is Chitra, who is going to do translation from Matsya Avatara Prabhu, and this is Chitra's assistant, because, you know, that's just the way it is. Everything maybe works in family groups. So I'm going to pose questions and try and keep out of the conversation as much as possible. I'm just here to perform that yogiest tapas for me to do that. And once we get a little conversation going, then we want to open it up to the floor as well. So again, the topic is joining worlds of knowledge, secular and Vaishnava academy. So Pranava Prabhu has helped in discussion with the other two speakers to develop the questions. And having looked at the questions, I may innovate. If all the speakers don't mind, I may innovate just a little bit. So I may ask some of the questions that they've agreed to answer, but I might ask the other participants, maybe even the same question. Okay, so the first question we will direct towards Dr. Scorcini, and it is insiders and outsiders, meaning people who are practicing a religious tradition and people who are not practicing that tradition, when they're studying possibly the same tradition, are they opposite or partners? So,
well, I'm not going to take that much time to explain that these are two very old way of addressing the issue. And especially within the last 10 years, a lot of scholars are openly declaring themselves to be believers, and vice versa, also those believers become scholars. And it seems that these have been perceived within the academy as a sign of the zeitgeist, changing climates, and more like opening doors and joining worlds of knowledge. But a lot of scholars, especially, of course, you can guess which side. A lot of scholars are concerned about this new way of opening doors, especially because scholars perceive that the insider-outsider has a very old discussion. It goes back to Schleiermacher and the German scholarship at the beginning, when they discovered that the Gospels, textual traditions has been discovered as coming from common roots, there is the synoptic problems. A lot of people were actually getting into trouble with their own faith because the gospel were not that much divine as they were thinking before, and therefore scholarship became the enemy for believers. And since then, the insider-outsider became a sort of epistemological problem to be established. In a way, you have insiders claiming that you need to be a believer in order to understand what's going on within religion. And on the other side, you have outsiders that were actually claiming the opposite. You do not need to be a believer. Rather, more than that, you don't have to be a believer if you want to really truly understand what's going on within religion. Of course, here you have the problem that these two guys were guessing out of the category of religion, what religion is about. They do not share the same category, and therefore they can speak that much radically against each other. But after years of debates, and there's a long, large literature about that, the problem of insider-outsiders was gradually dissolving because of the two fields becoming more independent of each other. You have the history in Europe of people teaching in the university paid by the state that are actually priests, like in Germany or any other northern European countries, or you have a separate context where the scholars were doing their own job as historians of religion, claiming themselves not to be believers, and these two worlds were like autonomous, gradually. And then I'm speaking about the early two decades of the 20th century. Very recently, the problem of insider-outsider came again on the spot because of a specific contextual historical scenario, mainly in America, and mainly due to the second, third generation immigrants. In other words, for example, are we familiar with the Hindu diaspora phenomenon in the United States? And you have a lot of new generations, Indian third generation coming to America, wanting to discover their own traditional culture, and therefore they want to go for the PhD. And since 2002, 2003, we have a lot of examples of Indians, both Sikh or Hindu, some sort of, claiming having problems with teachers that are not Hindus. And because they are not into private, in the public university, they went to the private university chair asking for, we pay $45,000 every year for the PhD. We don't like to have this guy teaching us that Ram is one of us, or we want to have more like traditional teachers. That became an issue. You can see very clearly in the American Academy of Religion, we have two different volumes dedicated to who speaks for the problem of who is representing traditional religions. And that became at that time like an epistemological problem. But with the years going on, it seems now that these are, again, a very nice opportunity for scholars that are secular and scholars that are religious to join into a very strange new effort. In other words, what I'm talking about is the last 2 years, we have a strange phenomenon. Scholars that are secular, declaring themselves not to be religious, and scholars that are religious, claiming themselves to belong to a specific tradition, Buddhists or Christians or Hindus, actually campaigning to defend, for example, the category of religion. Because the category of religion is under a strong attack, as being produced by colonial people, doesn't represent the local realities. You can't apply the idea of religion for Japan, for example, the scholar says, or you can't find any religion in China, and what to speak in India. Maybe religion is some sort of, you can talk about religion for the neo-colonial period, but you can't speak about religion for medieval time, or even for ancient and Vedic and so on. And therefore, there is a bunch of scholars that are strongly against using those categories, like conversion, faith, religion, and in a way, the phenomenon has been described as a vanification, a dissolving phenomena of all these categories that are, you can see, are very important for both religion, religious studies scholars, and religious people. Precisely. I can show you here, and I'm going to stop, just giving you these three examples. These three phenomena, scholars that declare themselves to be secular, scholars that declare themselves to be believers, are acting as an enemy, with a common enemy, against people outside there that are destroying what they say, their own field, especially the basic assumptions, like the basic notion of categories. The good example is that, a very good example is like, this is a book, this is a book made by Russell McCutcheon. Now it's becoming famous historians of religion, but at the time of this book it was not that much well known. And the book is called Critics, Not Caretakers, redescribing the public study of religion. Here you have a very specific, a very clear example of a scholar that is really secular, really against the hegemony of religion, of religious traditions, that they do not want anybody else to speak about religion if they are not religious. And within this book, it's like he's inviting the colleagues, scholars, secular scholars, to take position against the idea that you can speak about religion and religious tradition or religion history only if you are in some sort inclined towards religion. And this has been perceived as a strong attack against the possibility for religious people to be scholars. Then you have the reaction after a few years to this kind of approach that has been also, McCutcheon is not the only one. This is a book by a group of scholars that has been published in 2007, widely announced as, you know, the reply to the secular academy that is against religion. And you see the title is very meaningful, Invading the Sacred, an analysis of Hinduism studies in America. These are scholars that are clearly religious, and they share the same problem. You know, they want to kill, including brackets, but Wendy Doniger recently has been in a real problem, you know, being threatened by Hindutvas or people like, you know, against her, killing her, actually. But here they are claiming invading space. There are people outside there that are invading our spaces. You know, it's like making a real serious problem here, using the post-colonial, the post-orientalist theories, and making the case that, you know, scholars that are secular are very dangerous. But on the other side, and I'm stopping here, just to make you feel that there is insider-outsider still available, you know, problem. At the same time, we have a bunch of scholars that are actually working in a very different direction, and I think that that's a direction that, if there are any possibility for future cooperation amongst believers and scholars that are secular, has to be looked very carefully. And that's a book came out in 2000. This is 2007. The first one was 2001. So these are things that are going on now, and this is a book coming from 2005. The title is very interesting, The Invention of World Religions. And the scholar that wrote this book, she's Japanese by origins, but she's teaching in America, Tomoko Masuzawa. This book is like making the case that, you know, we talk about religion, singular, and therefore we can speak about religions, plural, just because at a certain point in history, a bunch of people decided that there is a universal category that we can address as a common ground for a large variety of phenomena. That category is religion. And therefore, we can expand that category into a world religion phenomenon. We everywhere we go, there are religious people, and therefore must be something inside those people that is a common ground. This book is like making the case, this book has been, you can imagine, has been radically attacked by both religious people, scholars, and secular scholars, because, you know, this is like dissolving the topic of their own lifestyle and of their own career. So it's too dangerous to talk like that. You know, if religion disappeared from the scenario, then what are we going to teach? Or on the other side, what are we going to preach? These two people are actually joining together now to attack those who are attacking the category that they are, you know, representing. So I'm here just to make these three pictures. People defending from each other before, scholars, seculars, and believers.
Now, other scholars are coming on the background, making the case, you don't have to fight. There is nothing to be fight on, because, religion doesn't exist. It's an invention. So, take your time, change your rounds, do your job, teach your student. That's all. So I think it's for looking for the future possibility to expand or joining together in common effort and grounds, it is necessary to face these historical developments in a way that the role that somebody can decide to enter in is more like is leading more than the next few days, because it seems here that these roads are very near to be closed soon. So that's my initial stimulus to the conversation.
Very good. Thank you very much for the compelling. Vintage Squarcini.
Could I ask Marcel Carpavu? I think what Vera has given us is a very good global overview, a kind of an audit of the history of the situation and right up to the present day, a very interesting developing discussion. In the work that you've done, so localized in Italy, so kind of on the ground, what strategies have you used to be able to join the Vaishnav and the secular? And it may include what kind of challenges have you faced. And you won't be able to take quite as much time as dear Fearlessly.
Oh, too much? I didn't know that, sorry.
You were on a roll, you couldn't stop yet.
Io chiedo scusa a tutti per la mia povertà della lingua inglese e quindi sono costretto a spiegarmi in italiano per tentare di poter offrire qualcosa.
I excuse myself for the limitations of my English language and therefore I'm forced to explain in Italian.
Il problema che ho fronteggiato negli ultimi 15 anni è stato soprattutto di linguaggio, prima ancora che epistemologico e prima ancora che euristico, proprio una questione di intenderci sul problema della lingua.
The first issue that I had to face in the last 50 years has been that of language. Prior to the problems of epistemology and heuristic.
Perché quel che divideva, quel che dicevo o quel che tentavo di affermare o di offrire, sempre naturalmente nello spirito dell'offerta, nello spirito di offrire una prospettiva di tipo bhakti-vedantico, era ancora prima un problema di linguaggio, prima ancora che di contenuto.
Because what I wanted to deliver in the spirit of an offering, as far as our Bhaktivedanta culture, was first of all a problem of language, more than of contents.
I campi di intervento li avevo identificati e intanto 3-4 potevano essere di sicuro interesse, non soltanto per noi che portavamo un messaggio bhakti-vedantico, ma anche per coloro che lo ricevevano anche in termini pratici, non soltanto di tipo spirituale, religioso o confessionale.
I had outlined 3 fields of action that could be very useful not only for us bhakti-vedanti, but also for people in terms of the spiritual,
not solo spiritual,
not only spiritual, but also the cultural and social impact.
Il primo è il tema della morte e il tema di come l'Accademia prende o non prende in considerazione il tema della morte, quindi quello della sofferenza proprio come una cifra esistenziale, come una realtà che sta sullo sfondo delle vite di tutti noi.
The first issue, the first topic is about death. the theme of death and how Academy takes into consideration or doesn't take into consideration the theme of death. Sufferance as a reality, which is at the back, is like a background in the lives of all of us.
E abbiamo visto, abbiamo potuto vedere che la modificazione del linguaggio, una trasformazione abbastanza sostanziale del linguaggio, ha potuto far entrare in scambio proficuo, in scambio costruttivo, il contenuto e il contributo che possiamo portare noi come Bhaktivedanta e quello che l'Accademia già possiede in termini di medicina e di psicologia.
We have seen that the modification of language and its substantial transformation
può permettere proprio un
exchange, a very prolific exchange, very constructive.
Contenuti, cioè quello che noi possiamo contribuire all'Accademia e quello che l'Accademia può contribuire a noi in un lavoro fatto assieme, un lavoro di collaborazione.
So we've created a prolific exchange between the content and the contribution that we can give as Bhaktivedanti and what the Academy already possesses in terms of medicine and psychology.
Il primo lavoro in questo senso è stato fatto come un tentativo, come una possibilità con il Ministero della Salute, con il Ministero della Salute italiano, con i corsi in ECM, Educazione Continua in Medicina, che poi hanno avuto un discreto successo e quindi hanno potuto essere continuati per 6 anni con il lavoro svolto nei più grandi ospedali del Centro Nord. È proprio una collaborazione che tra poco dirò come è iniziata, come si è sviluppata e che appunto è adesso.
Our first work in this direction has been the possibility with the Ministry of Health, Italian Ministry of Health, to erogate, to give out, offer courses in continuous education in medicines that have been given with a lot of success for 6 years in collaboration with the most important Italian hospitals.
Ed è notevole, ad esempio, vedere come in questo lavoro l'interesse principale è stato suscitato in accademici, in persone che avevano un loro taglio, una loro prospettiva, un loro approccio a questa materia. E tant'è vero che i primi seminari sono stati svolti presso l'Ordine degli Psicologi della Lombardia, svolti da me a partire dal 2002.
It's noteworthy to see how this work has gained the interest of academics, of people who had their own approach to the subject. As a matter of fact, the first seminars were given in the year 2002 by the Order of Psychologists in the region Lombardia, northern Italy.
In realtà era un lavoro di completamento, o se si vuole, un lavoro di complementarietà, perché affrontare la sofferenza, affrontare il rapporto con la scomparsa, con l'evento morte e soprattutto con l'elaborazione del lutto, e sia quello anticipato, sia quello posticipato, sia chi parte, sia chi resta, quindi la morte come fenomeno bilaterale, era qualcosa che all'Accademia interessava e noi abbiamo potuto portare un contributo che resta a tutt'oggi.
So in reality this was a complementary job, a job of completing, because to approach sufferance and the relationship with death, the event of death, and the elaboration of after death, both on the side of who remains and who departs, was something that the Academy was interested in, and we could actually bring a contribution which is still ongoing.
Questo tipo di lavoro è la psicologia dell'assistenza ai malati terminali e ai loro familiari.
This type of work was assisting families of the departed and assisting the departed.
Malati terminali, terminali.
So terminal illness.
E questa
terminal ill people.
Questa collaborazione è stata fatta soprattutto in ospedali in cui c'erano cliniche universitarie, in cui l'aspetto, definiamolo più fisico, più prettamente psicologico, ma di tipo oggettivo, si poteva coniugare con uno psicologico che aveva più contatto con il principio ordinatore interno, che hanno accettato come ipotesi, come teoria, e hanno visto ne hanno vista l'applicazione, e in molti casi ci sono state degli approfondimenti che poi sono diventati dei metodi o dei sistemi o delle procedure che hanno adottato loro stessi per portare avanti la loro professione.
So this collaboration went on in hospitals which had some university departments where the physical aspect could be conjugated, could be linked to the psychological aspect.
And where the psicologia secolare, molto oggettiva, molto.
And where they could accept the hypothesis that, that there can be many cases of many study cases. Actually, these study cases have become adopted procedures. And they have taken them on, and they are carrying them on within their as their treatments. They're using them as treatments. They're using, you know, the study cases that we have offered as part of their treatments.
In questo caso, il contributo che noi abbiamo potuto dare a quel tipo di accademia, a quel tipo di procedure, accademia di medicina, accademia in cui si insegna la scienza medica e anche la scienza psicologica, una scienza psicologica che non prevedeva e che non aveva un rapporto diretto con la presenza di un principio coordinatore che noi nella nostra tradizione chiamiamo Atman o Anima.
So actually we have furnished them with an underlying principle that they didn't have before and that we call Atman in our tradition. In this case, this is the big contribution that we could give to their medical academy.
Beh, apparirebbe come la scoperta dell'acqua calda, perché in ogni ospedale italiano ci sono sempre stati all'interno preti, suore, frati, quindi un tipo di conforto di tipo religioso che abbiamo sempre avuto, ma l'approccio che abbiamo potuto dare è stato completamente diverso, riconosciuto come praticamente diverso. Ovvero un contributo, se si vuole, anche qui andrebbe messo tra virgolette, con una procedura alla più larga possibile definita sperimentale. Sperimentale perché questo tipo di atteggiamento in cui si veniva a trovare il paziente o coloro che curavano i pazienti diventava propedeutico alla loro serenità, almeno a una loro situazione di stabilità interiore senza necessità di farmacologia pesante.
This sounds like the discovery of hot water because, as a matter of fact, in Italian hospitals and all hospitals in general, there have always been priests and nuns. But the approach that we could give was very different and it has been recognized as such because we offered a procedure defined as experimental. Because the attitude with which they could treat patients with our contribution in this way favored the internal stability and the peacefulness
of the patients.
Actually, they could center themselves, go back to be self-centered, centered in themselves, and approach the illness with a very quiet and peaceful attitude.
Rapidissimamente, perché il tempo è terminato, lo stesso approccio, seppure con canali diversi, è stato per l'economia.
The same approach, although with different channels, we could offer with economy.
Nella formazione dei quadri dirigenti per le imprese.
In the formation of leaders in enterprises.
E adesso ultimamente nel settore del counseling, che è a banda larga, per così dire, interessante per varie discipline, principalmente con un linguaggio umanistico e non psicologico, con un linguaggio umanistico e non medico, e un linguaggio umanistico e non semplicemente economico o economicistico. Quindi un approccio che può venire attraverso un linguaggio adeguato a quel campo di intervento, facendo tesoro degli insegnamenti della nostra tradizione.
Recently, we have developed the area of counseling, which is a widespread area, very interesting for various disciplines, especially for the use of a humanistic language, and not psychological, but humanistic language, not medical or simply
economical.
So it's wider than that. So this approach can come through the through an adequate language. It can be offered through an adequate language to any field of intervention with reference to our Bhaktivedanta culture.
Okay, thank you very much. Very interesting strategies of relating the secular with the Vaishnava. And now I'd like to call on Pranava, if you could address in your work as a researcher, so the issues that Vera was bringing up of insider, outsider, so you are an insider studying your own tradition in the academy. So I'd like, if you could just reflect, and I'm sorry to say you can't take as much time as we've been generously
5 minutes
giving it on. That'd be great. Thank you very much. But if you could look at how you were able to deal with the relationship between both while functioning within the academy.
Yes.
Thank you. I'll try to.
Seven minutes.
Thank you. Yes, basically, I entered the academy because, well, for various reasons. But one reason was that I firmly believed that there was a possibility to have a dialogue between these two quite different cultural spheres. We were listening this morning about having alien cultures and indigenous cultures. So the academy, in one sense, is alien culture to Vaishnavism. It's a specific history that has grown within the context of Western European culture, civilization, and the Christianity. So when I decided to start a PhD program and embark in this research study of Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati, I met immediately a very important question that I had to address. Some internal questions relevant to the tradition that was my own tradition that I was dealing with, and the other challenges were external, the way other scholars or professors would look at my own endeavors. So from the internal point of view, well, one thing was what I would be looking for. Just very quickly, a very good friend of mine in my department, he's a priest in the Swedish church, and he wrote a doctoral thesis that has created an uproar in Sweden and abroad. And he has been researching the oldest sources of Christian Christian textual traditions, and questioned the fact that Jesus was actually crucified. He hasn't found evidence that actually he was put on the cross, that Jesus died on the cross, but opened the possibility that he was maybe killed in a different way, not questioning that the death of Jesus, but just the way it was done. And some of his colleagues, of course, more kind of open-minded, welcomed that effort. But some of his Christian brothers and sisters, they found this very discomforting and quite challenging to deal with. So in my own perspective, then I had to make a choice immediately. Did I want to challenge my own tradition and question the most fundamental, the key assumption of the tradition, which some scholars, even believing scholars do, and they think it's important to do, or did I want to maybe leave that task to someone else, so to speak, and deal with issues that were important for the tradition and even for the scholarly community, but could be more like going more in depth in the tradition and kind of creating a stronger ground for the tradition to develop. So that was the first decision. So then I decided to try to work in a way and find issues and topics that were relevant both for the academic work and for the devotional community. And the choice of working with Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati has been also the choice of dealing with a very sensitive issue, because Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati is very important for our tradition, but even for the Gaudiya Math and many other traditions. So it was not easy to to make that decision. And then there was issues of whether I would focus on Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati as a person, or I would just see him as a representative of a larger movement, of an intellectual history idea movement, of Vaishnavism in that sense, and not specifically on the person. And so then I took that decision to focus on the person. So there were many decisions I had to take, and what kind of supervisors? One of my supervisors I chose it would be a professor who is also a devotee, in order to keep the kind of balance between the academy and the Vaishnava sensibility. And the other Swedish professor was a person who was not a devotee, in fact, not very religious at all. So, but it was important for me to have the kind of balance. And just a few words about the external challenges. Well, one challenge would have been a challenge of credibility, because if when one writes about your own tradition, especially about a personality that has contributed so much to the tradition, then obviously outsider or scholars who are not Vaishnavas will start questioning, what do you want to do? Do you want to write a hagiography to praise him and show to the world that he's a very important spiritual personality, or what do you want to do? So it was a question of credibility. I had to kind of show somehow or other that I was not just, I wanted to go further than do something else than a pure geographic work. And another challenge from the external point of view would be, how would I treat the opponents of Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati? Would I write a work that would be apologetic, that just defending our tradition against other attacks? Or would it be a kind of a balanced presentation, more kind of inclusive? And also, would my work focus on a very narrow, like just focus on our tradition and following the life of Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati in a way that really would contribute to our tradition's own understanding of its history? Or would I look on a much broader scale to the historical, social, cultural events around Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati and kind of understand his contribution in a much broader context? So finally, I had to do all these things. I had to look on a broader way. I had to treat fairly his Bhaktisiddhanta's opponents and give them also space to express their ideas in order to make the presentation acceptable and reasonably credible for the academic professor I was dealing with. So these are some of the challenges that I was dealing with.
Very good. Thank you very much. So we don't have to talk about her in the presentation. A bit too formal for a conversation. And now, this next question is entering a little bit more into the conversational element, and I would appreciate very short answers, if you don't mind, as much as humanly and intellectually possible. We'll start with Vera. I'm going to ask a question that I would like Pranava and Masyavatar to respond to his answer. So just upping the temperature just a little bit. Now, it's going to be very good. By the way, all our speakers are Italian. Just thought I'd mention that. It's culturally correct. We've ticked a lot of boxes here. This is good. We have two women here because we didn't have a woman speaker, but we just got two women just. And one of them is homosexual. I'll find another one. Okay, the question is. Yeah, I'm outing someone. And they're not even homosexual. How do we evaluate the epistemic legitimacy of the secular and Vaishnav academies?
Well, that's difficult. The problem of credibility that you are raising here to be accredited, to be recognized, to be accepted, there is a large variety of what credibility is about. And to be accepted or to be taken as a reference point are two different, on the other side of the world. So the evaluation of the epistemic value of what scholars do, or the evaluation of the epistemic values of believers that behave as scholars, because we are talking about them, at the same time is like, which side are you achieving the top level of credibility, or are you just looking for a minimal acceptance? So I think the problem here is like, let me give an example. Scholars and believers in Hindu studies, contemporary situation, they both share a received view. There is the Vedic. The Veda, because there are the Veda, there is the Vedic. Doesn't make any, it's a very natural syllogism, because they are the Veda, must be the Vedic. From the historical point of view, and if you are a philologist especially, it is very hard to prove with the existent textual material that we have. We don't know if Agastya Muni in his own mind believes things, scholars. You may, as a believer, have access to Agastya or Kashyapa or all these people out there, and they may know, or they may tell you that the Vedic is the, you know, original or whatever. But in the existent textual material, we do not have any single quotes about Vedic as a Vaidika terms earlier than the second, third century before Christ, calculated within the philological networking system that we establish as scholars, and that very often is accepted by believers that behave as a scholar to access to the credibility. So here, do scholars that arrange a system for check and balance to establish what historical textual materials is about, if they establish that, I mean, very recently, the problem of Vaidika came out after 150 years of Indological scholarship. They discovered that Vaidika, which is a radical notion everybody talk about, the Vedic, whatever textual handbook of Indian culture, you have the section of Vedic, whatever. And so there's no, Vedic is something that authors later use to address older materials. So it's like an internal category is established by authors to describe previous materials and to receive from that description legitimacy, credibility. So it's like a second-hand category. It doesn't belong to the initial way of addressing themselves. So it is not a self-representative category. It's like to address Christianity with the eyes of Luther. Early Christian community, how they were describing themselves. So for an historian, that's a very important problem. And therefore, even scholars that are believers accept the Vedic as a way of addressing their own tradition to establish credibility and legitimacy. I think here, scholars and believers, in order to evaluate the epistemological level of what they are doing, has to face a rearrangement of the way that they look at their own textual material, both traditional scholars and secular scholars. Because here we face the same problem. We are actually misunderstanding something that people after 10 centuries were telling to others of their own time about very ancient, for them, textual theory. And that was not out of, you know, they had interest in that. We do not know why they decided to address their own tradition as vague at that time. Well, we scholars know that because Buddhists were challenging and whatever. So I'm trying to say there are notions that are established by traditions that scholars and contemporary believers, they do share the same credibility to that notion, but that notion has to be radically reviewed. And I think this is a job that can be done together, but at the same time, we have to be careful because sometimes we reinforce each other in a way that we, you know, promote viruses, which are not healthy for even for religious tradition to be, you know, like what you are doing. I think coming out from Baptist Adventist, it's a lot of stuff that we do not know that could be like a very resourceful material for a tradition that has to be arranged to match the contemporary situation. So I think that would be like, I'm not going to say challenging, you know, this word doesn't mean anything, you know, it's not challenging anybody, nobody to challenge anybody. But it's like a problem that I'm facing, and I think it's something that we have, scholars, believers, or whatever, they have to face.
Very good. Matthew, you want to respond?
Il problema sollevato da Federico è un problema che la storia ha affrontato fino dall'inizio del sorgere delle questioni di autenticità sulle tradizioni, sulle credenze e sulla professione di fede.
The problem that Federico has posed is a problem that history has faced since the beginning of the inception of questions on authenticity, on traditions, beliefs and professions of faith.
E tutti conosciamo gli sforzi, i tentativi che sono stati fatti dall'amministrazione britannica per trasformare la visione, il concetto, l'immagine della tradizione ai credenti di quella tradizione stessa e di come questi testi sono stati poi tradotti per gli occidentali con commenti che appartenevano sicuramente non a quella tradizione ma a una nuova interpretazione della tradizione.
We all know the efforts made by the British administration to transform the vision, the concepts and the image of tradition for the believers of that same tradition, and how this text has been translated from Western people with comments that did not belong to that tradition, but to a new interpretation of that tradition.
Quello che noi possiamo riconoscere dalla storia abbastanza recente, da ciò che è ancora testuale e relativamente facile accesso a vedere quello che è successo negli ultimi 2-3 secoli, ci può dare un'immagine di qualcosa sia successo nei millenni precedenti, nella rivalutazione, nella reinterpretazione, anche a motivi politici, anche per motivi di semplice potere o anche di nuovo reindirizzo religioso.
What we can recognize in recent history, according to what is of easily accessible, I run into that. What we can recognize in recent history, taking what is accessible as far as texts in the last two or three centuries, can give us an image of what might have happened in the preceding millenniums in the reinterpretation, as far as the reinterpretation of text for political, religious, or motives, or simply motives of power, motivations of power.
È una questione che appare, come giustamente era già stato sollevato prima, anche nella figura del Cristo. Il Cristo è un ebreo per gli ebrei, è uno dei tanti messia. Per i cristiani è qualcosa di radicalmente nuovo, di totalmente nuovo, di totalmente divino.
As it was said before, we can rightly say that it's a question that appears also in the figure of Christ, who is a Jew for the Jewish and for the Christians.
Uno dei tanti messia.
It's like just one of the messiahs for the Jews, and for the Christians he's a completely new and divine figure.
Dunque anche lì c'è una rielaborazione del materiale antico, del materiale precedente, dei contenuti biblici, ma riletti con una nuova ottica e interpretati con una nuova comportamentistica, con una nuova via di messa in pratica. Quindi il cristianesimo poi diventa qualcosa di ben distinto rispetto al materiale antico, e questo credo che sia qualcosa che è successo in tutte le tradizioni, e perché non alla tradizione vedica, per cui forse è troppo lungo come.
Here also we have a re-elaboration of the ancient material of the Bible, of biblical contents, with a new perspective, then being reinterpreted with a new behavioral approach, with a new practical approach. Therefore, Christianity has become something very different from the ancient material. It's something that has happened in all traditions, so why not also in our Vaishnava tradition?
Ha preso 2000 anni per riconoscere proprio recentissimamente che il cristianesimo, insomma, è parte integrante dell'ebraismo, e che l'ebraismo non è qualcosa di così altro rispetto al cristianesimo, ma ci sono stati 2000 anni di contese anche feroci e sanguinose.
It has taken 2000 years of very ferocious also conflicts just to recognize that Christianity is in an integral part of Hebraism. And it's not something so different from.
No, è differente, immagino, è una sua peculiarità, ma condivide del materiale antico.
Yeah, so it is different, but it does share some very ancient material with Judaism.
È auspicabile che anche l'Islam arrivi a questa conclusione, che questa matrice semitica ha prodotto questi tre monoteismi medio orientali, tutti da una stessa radice, ma che si chiamano con nomi diversi, e che naturalmente possano essere considerati allo stesso tempo e diversi, e anche provenienti dallo stesso materiale originario.
So we wish that Islam can also come to the same conclusion, that the Semitical matrix is the same and has produced these three monotheistic Middle Eastern traditions. So at the same time they can be considered as different, but also coming from the same matrix.
Quindi sicuramente il tempo ha proprio come propria funzione, proprio la funzione del tempo, di far maturare queste credenze, e all'interno della funzione storica, all'interno del dispiegamento del tempo, si trovano differenze e similitudini che possono essere trattate in modo diverso a secondo dell'ottica di chi le tratta. Se chi le tratta semplicemente per farne delle categorie o per farne una classificazione per l'archivio, è un conto. Se le tratta per invece calarle nella pratica, nella loro vitalità, deve trovare una ennesima maniera per poterle calare in quel tempo, in quel luogo, in quella circostanza.
So certainly one of the functions of time is to let these beliefs mature. And in time also we can find differences or similitudes that can be treated in different ways according to the of our attitude, the attitude of the observer. So we can treat them just as classifications for archives, or better, we can take them into our we can use them in our according to time, place and circumstance. We can reinterpret them.
Thank you very much. And Pranava, could you also address the response?
Yes.
Both responses.
Yes. There is a tension between the point of view of the insider and the outsider, academic scholar. Obviously, there is a tension there. But there is a different kind of interest, because if you think about in academics, at least in the history of religions, we talk about emic and ethic distinction. The emic is the perspective of a scholar who can be an insider or outsider, but he really tries to, as we heard today, wear the other person's shoes, and really get so as close as possible to the tradition that the scholar is studying. And the ethic perspective is when you stand outside of it and you draw a conclusion, scholarly, putting the phenomenon you're studying within a much larger scholarly discourse, and you use academic language, you don't use the insider language anymore, you use the outsider language. And there is a way to see, in later scholarship, at least the one I'm looking at particularly, there is a tendency, the attempt, to try to use both emic and ethic perspective at the same time. Because if one uses only the emic perspective, there is a case that it becomes too colored by a particular vision of the believers. But if it's only ethic from the outside, then scholarship can become easily covered by other interests, like a scholar who, as we've heard, as early Indologists, they were paid by the, like Max Müller, he was paid by the East India Company, and his work was in many ways part of a much larger colonial project, and much of scholarship about India that grew up in the West up to the Second World War was covered by a certain kind of economic, political interest. So I would say that it's necessary to find a kind of balance, and there is, I think, on one side the tendency from a number of scholars to become a little bit subservient to a particular economic interests, like in the European Union, for example. The European Union invests billions of euros every year in research, but it's very much driven by political purposes, like it's very much social studies oriented. Research has to be useful, so to speak. It has to improve the condition of the people, their social condition, their economic condition. It has to be a very clear goal. So if it's not like that, if it's only kind of historical or philosophical, theological, it's very difficult to get funds. So there are all these kind of the academic world nowadays is driven by many kind of forces going in many different directions. And but there is, as Federico was mentioning, there are scholars who are really trying to bridge also these different interests and maintain a kind of authenticity in representing the tradition, different religious traditions, while having a dialogue with forces that are external to the religious traditions themselves, and try to find kind of a balance.
Very good, thank you, Pranava. I'd like to now open it to the floor if anyone would like to participate in the conversation to make a point. It doesn't have to necessarily address any individual person, it doesn't have to be a question, but it's to just further this discussion. What are the issues involved in the insider-outsider, they involved in epistemology and legitimacy, etc. So Gori has his hand up, and Kofi Ansari has his hand up, and Barbara has her hand up in that order. Sarah.
Who first?
Gori. So as I say, it doesn't have to be a question. It can just be...
I'm just interested to hear what Federico would have to say about this point of balance that's being made by...
It can be a question as well, yeah.
Yeah, you know, so does he see that that's a compromised approach which is accommodating something which is not strictly academic? Balance, is it possible? Is it worth anything, or is it just a deviation from, you know, proper research and study?
Deviation from truth.
Yeah, deviation. No, I may not be able to express myself very well. I was precisely addressing the problem of interest behind the academic effort and the interest behind the religious effort. I mean, religions has their own interests. Academics, funding problems, they have their own, and within the academics there are fields, you know, historicists, phenomenologists, para, semi, phenomenologists, or partially historicists, you know, as in any religious tradition. Now think about Iskra. Iskra doesn't have a singular viewpoint on itself. Therefore, there are interests within. We are together as academics, but at the same time, we are not, because we share partially the same field, and at the same time, we have to fight for, you know, the daily bread. So the problem up here is compromising. It's not just that we are compromising because we are getting the fund from the European Union, and because the European Union wants us to work on sexuality in religion, we need to do a larger project because of that. We don't care about the topic, but we need to get that fund in order to do our own very lovely critical edition during the night. So. I think here compromises is a problem that we have to be addressed, entirely radically new problem for both of us, academics and religious, because if the religious people, I mean, think about writing a PhD on Sarasvati, Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati, can give you a lot of problem. Or do you have to compromise? If you find, let's say, a letter that Bhaktisiddhanta was describing himself as a tantrika, what are you doing? Are you publishing that? Are you hiding that? If you publish that, you know, you go to hell. You are not going to be accepted in Goloka Vrindavan. That's a problem. Or, you know, so compromising here is, in my eyes, is something that we have to readdress, partially drawing from these two traditions, academic and religious scholarship, that maybe we can help each other to make a, like, more stable ground for making statement out of the research results. It's not just the problem of the academics that are corrupted, as we know in the statement of, these are not just people, armchair speculators. They have their own family, they do what they need to do for survival, as any religious institution or any religious leaders. He has his own interests. Yeah, he's telling us that he's doing the good for, but we know that there are behind there are things going on. So I think compromise is one precise point that we should work on for future on both sides.
Thank you very much. Govinda, sir.
I'm sorry, I also have a question. Well, it's kind of a statement involving a question. Several things that several of you have said, it's about the respect practitioners receive in the academy, and also the respect they get in their own religious communities as academics, and sort of the way they're seen to act in the academic world as practitioners. And it's basically the issue of proselytization, or having a certain agenda of changing either the academic world or just particular people, as more specific, where it seems from the religious community, often the perspective is that of non-academics within a religious community, that the academics of the religious community are there to, you know, keep the faith in a sense, defend the faith and have that mission. Whereas the critics of practitioners in the academy is basically this, often the same thing, that you're just here to promote your own religious agenda, to sort of defend this. And my question is sort of along the lines of something, sort of how would you respond to this? How would you sort of see this? And it's sort of initially my question is something that Federico was talking about as well. How would you then deal with sort of differences if you find a letter of Protestant that is said where he says I'm a donkey? How do you deal with that? Would the academy allow for a certain sort of lenience in certain areas, or is it sort of black and white? Is the academy
just 5 questions is enough. That's okay.
Maybe I should say a few words.
I didn't find the letter. I'm sorry.
It wasn't there.
Right. No. Well, first of all, any scholar. I mean, when. First of all, when you do research, you collect enormous amount of material, and then as a scholar, you have to filter it down. And not everything has to be said. You don't have to say everything. And some things may be very harmful to certain communities, they may be very damaging to different groups in different ways. But as a scholar, if you work in a scholarly environment, then you're expected to have a certain kind of integrity and authenticity. So if there is actually something that really leaves, you can't forward to some facts that are very evident and very clear. So as a scholar, you're not expected to hide it unless there is a certain reason for that. That is, it would be very damaging for certain groups or something like that. So it's a combination practicing integrity as a scholar. With the expectation to come forward to some kind of truth, and at the same time as a practitioner, choosing certain kind of topics which are productive and interesting for the tradition, and trying to combine the two. More or less that's the way I would look at it.
Okay, Barbara? Anyone else have something, some questions? Just put up your hand now, just saying. No, apart from yourself, but just...
Well, first I just want to make a comment, then I have a question for Federico. Can I do both?
You can do both. Good girl.
Okay. I've been interested in this issue of, sort of the politics of identity in the academy. I mean, I've worked in Hindu traditions on the one hand, I work on Jewish traditions on the other. And what I've been very interested in, just thinking about some of these issues, is that it's actually... If you look at different cases, the question is, what tradition are you studying? The whole insider-outsider problem is viewed very differently. So it has been the norm, historically, that Christian scholars will be teaching and studying Christian traditions. There's never been any question about the appropriateness of that. On the other hand, and then in Jewish studies, the implicit norm is that it's fine, in fact, to some extent, preferable to be Jewish. I mean, if you're not Jewish and you're doing the study of Jewish traditions, you're somewhat held in suspicion. At least, I mean, there is, it's not overt, but there's sort of some politics involved there. But when we shift to Hindu traditions, I've been really interested to see, again, because I'm like working between these two traditions, I see very different dynamics. That if one's studying Hindu traditions in the academy, I think it's part of the legacy of Orientalism. But there is a kind of a stance that it's better not to be part of the tradition. And so, in recent years in the American religion, in the South Asian religion section, there's been an attempt to kind of grapple with some of these issues and try and kind of clarify what's going on here. Why is it that, for example, there was a grad student in my department, I remember when I first came to UCSB, his name was Ron Dustman. And he had been a Ramananda monk for 8 years and lived in India. He was a Roman Catholic, Italian descent, living in LA, grew up in LA. But he'd gone and lived in India. His name was Ramananda plus lamb for initiation. So when I came to UCSB, I don't know, he was telling me that he felt very comfortable because of his mentors in the academy were saying, you know, you need to change your name if you want to get a job. And he was saying, you know, that's who I am. Why should I change my name? But this has raised, it raised a number of issues, and through time, actually, I've noticed in the South Asian religious section of American religion, attempt to kind of grapple with what are these issues of identity in terms of South Asian studies, Hindu studies, and actually there's very different norms between Hindu and Buddhist studies. Because historically, there have been Buddhist studies scholars who form both the yogin and the Tao. So there's always been a certain sense of it's okay to be Buddhist. And in fact, when we were hiring for a particular position in Buddhist studies, and someone raised a question, well, this person's insider, and I said, I don't think we could raise those questions because it's actually illegal in the public university to do that. But beyond that fact, if you're just looking for an outsider, you're not going to find many. Because in fact, a large percentage of Buddhist studies scholars are practicing Buddhist. But what's interesting to me is that the Hindu studies case, it really does study, it's very different. There has been a kind of a level of prejudice, I think, against people with the being insiders, and that could mean not just people of European or European American heritage calling themselves Hindu and somehow doing wanting to study something Hindu about one less land. But even I've talked to colleagues who are South Asian heritage, and they have found that there's been a certain level of prejudice against them if it's found out that they are actually practicing Hindus during Hindu studies. So I think, you know, this whole insider-outsider question is very complicated in academy. And I think, you know, there's different kinds of histories, and I think the kinds of prejudices that maybe ISKCON's devotees have found going into the academy are part of this larger issue around the different norms of different kinds of traditions and who can be inside and it's okay, and who can be in, and who should be an outsider to be okay. Anyways, just a reflection that maybe we can talk a little bit about. Did I ask my question first?
You have to hurry up.
Okay.
We have four minutes for the question and the answer.
Just a question. When you're saying that the term Vaidika, you're saying it's a post-Vedic term. I mean, what are you saying? What are you dating the first use of the term Vaidika?
One of the latest Shrauta Sutras, so it's about third, early 4th century before.
Okay, so my question to you is, by that you mean Vaidika, not obviously the term Veda, right?
No, Vaidika, precisely. Right.
Okay. So, I mean, I guess I'm interested in terms of, I see a lot in terms of my work on Veda, I saw a lot of self-reflection about what is the category of Veda in the Veda text itself. So you're saying that you're just talking about the specific term Vaidika, that term is not used in the earlier Vedic text as a self-reflective term. But you would, of course, allow for the, there's a lot of reflection about what is Veda, right?
Yep.
What is a mantra, what are the riches, yajusas, samhitas, obviously
definitely
shifting terms in different texts. But there is a kind of self-reflexivity even in the earlier text.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you think is the importance of that distinction? I mean, when, you know, the term Veda has clearly been a term that's been used in the earlier period. What do you see is the shift is taking place? You say it's the later traditions looking back that somehow now this becomes a rubric for the authoritative traditions. Is that the distinction you want to make?
Yeah. Exactly.
Give me the microphone.
Oh, sorry.
Just say yes.
Yes, exactly. The precise occurrence of the Vaidika as a taxon to establish that since then, and now, we can address, because Vaidika was meant for internal reflection on textual materials, but here, in these texts, especially because they are normative texts, it becomes a taxon to address, and like an objective, you can have a ritual, Vaidika ritual, you can have Vaidika food, you can have Vaidika marriage. Before was not that the case. So it seems that there's a higher level of reflexivity here, acting as something to be used for redescribing past events and dragging legitimacy for something that has been going on, which was not that much clear anymore. So it's clear that it's something that I would say invented, but to add
level of legitimacy to something that was like largely accepted amongst an elite without as being criticized. So you have to rearrange the value of credibility, some sort of, okay, because these are normative texts that it comes from, especially Avastambhar and these other few Dhamma sutras. But that's definitely before they were thinking about what they were doing, but not in the same specific level of reflexivity, I would say.
Thank you all very much. I would specifically like to thank Matsya Avatar Das, Pranava, Federico for interesting, stimulating conversation. I would like to thank our two translators. Thank you very much indeed for a good job well done. Thank you all. We will meet back again in 15 minutes.